This is an incredible festival in an incredible town filled with incredible people. Thank you, Osley. Thank you, Christy. Thank you, Mustafa. Thank you, Sarah, and everyone else. Thank you, everyone, for coming and being part of this. Without you, it wouldn't happen. There were two questions that were raised earlier in the week and this morning, and I'd like to, if we can, in our panel, in our discussion time, come back to these questions. The first one was impartiality and compassion. Is it possible to be impartial and yet be compassionate? And the second question that was raised this morning was, is there another way to compassion other than through empathy? In other words, maybe there's a way that is maybe less painful, and also there may be other corollaries to cultivating compassion, things like skillful means, things like wisdom. So maybe we'll be able to address those questions and other things. We have an incredible afternoon for you with some world-class music that I think will melt you. And we have some incredible people that walk the talk and will be talking from their heart and are also incredibly accomplished. Let me introduce first, Dr. Ingrid Mattson, who's a leading Muslim religious and scholar. She's a professor of Islamic studies and an expert on the Quran. She was elected vice president and then president of the Islamic Society of North America and was the first woman to serve in each of those capacities. And I believe that's one of the largest groups of Muslims around the world. In that capacity, a 2010 New York Times article called her the most noticed figure among American Muslim women. She's also been called one of the 500 most influential leading Muslims around the world. As a professor at Hartford Seminary, she's developed and directed the first accredited graduate program for Muslim chaplains in America. And currently, Dr. Mattson teaches at the Western University of Ontario. Second, we have Thupten Jinpa, who's been twice introduced, but I'd like to introduce him again. He's a longtime friend. He's the, as been said, and I think many of you know, the English translator for His Holiness the Dalai Lama for about 30 years, since I believe 1985. He received his Geshe degree, and a Geshe degree comes after 20 plus years of rigorous study and debate, the Socratic method, in India at the Ganden Chartse Monastic University in South India. He also received his PhD in religious studies from Cambridge University. He's translated and edited more than 10 books with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, including the New York Times bestseller, Ethics for a New Millennium. He's authored many books, and his most recent one is called A Fearless Heart, and it's about compassion. He's founded and is the president and the editor-in-chief of the Institute of Tibetan Classics, where he, with a team that he's leading, is translating 32 of the most important Buddhist texts throughout history since the time of the Buddha. He's chairman of the board of the Mind and Life Institute, as you know from this morning. And he's also provided content for the Stanford C-Care, the Center for Compassion, Altruism, Research, and Education at Stanford University, which is an ongoing training compassion program. And many, many people have come out of that program, and he designed the curriculum. I'd like to thirdly introduce Cynthia Bourgeau, who is an Episcopalian priest. She spends much of her time in solitude, abiding in a non-dual mental state. She didn't tell me that, but others did. Actually, it was one of her publishers mentioned that to me. As a meditator, author, and retreat leader, she's actively recovering the Christian contemplative path. As an advocate of centering prayer, she's worked closely with Father Thomas Keating. Cynthia Bourgeau is a founding director of both the Aspen Wisdom School and the Contemplative Society. She's currently a core faculty member at the Living School for Action and Contemplation. Her numerous books include the best-selling Centering Prayer and Inner Awakening. And now it's my great pleasure to welcome Dr. Ingrid Mattson.
Good afternoon and greetings of peace. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, the compassionate, the most merciful. I'm not saying that just for today. We always begin with those words as Muslims. Apologies for being behind this big podium. I wore yellow so you can still find me, see me where I am. My beloved daughter returned to our Creator recently. And so as many of you know, that when you're in mourning, a big part of your mind is so preoccupied with that loss. So today I said, you know what, I'm gonna rely on a podium and a few cards just to help remind me in case I start to, I love to be with her and think of her, but I need to be here with you. So out of compassion for myself, and I know you'll grant me that, I'm giving myself these supports, and we all need some supports at different times. At the end of kindergarten in Canada, where I grew up, we didn't start school till we were 5 years old. And I grew up in a family of seven children, between whom there was a 10-year age difference. So between the oldest and the youngest, there was only 10 years. I was the sixth child. So you can imagine in that situation, even with wonderful parents and other family members, I sometimes felt that I didn't quite get the attention that I wanted or I deserved. So at the end of kindergarten, on the last day, the teacher got up at the front of the classroom and said, I'm going to announce who is the girl of the year and who is the boy of the year. And I won girl of the year. And I was given this large, fragrant, white gardenia. It was just beautiful, just full of this beautiful fragrance and lovely and soft to the touch. And she gave it to me and I held it and I felt very, you know, very special, really. And after that, I walked outside with the rest of the class and I was standing there feeling happy, holding this flower, when a classmate, who I will call for the purposes of protecting her identity, I'll call her today Dee Dee came up, she grabbed the flower, she threw it on the ground, she stamped on it and said, "What makes you so special?" And I was a little bit afraid. I wasn't sure if the violence was also going to be transferred to me. And I was sad, looking at my lovely flower squished and stomped on the ground. But behind all of that, As I looked at her face, there was a much stronger and more lasting emotion that I can feel until today. I'm 53, it was a long time ago. And that was a deep sense of compassion for her. I could see the pain on her angry little face. She was so small and skinny. And I realized that in her words, when she said, "What makes you so special?" what she was saying is, "Why am I not special? Why didn't anyone see that I'm special too?" Where does this compassion come from? The compassion that overrode my sadness, my being upset at the loss of the flower, the fear that maybe she would become violent with me. I was only a child. As a Muslim, reflecting upon it over the last many years and learning that compassion, in fact, is what my teacher, Dr. Omar Abdullah, calls the stamp of creation. Other than the personal name Allah, which means the God in Arabic, the next name, personal name of God is Ar-Rahman, the compassionate. Sometimes people translate it as the merciful, and then the word that's paired with it, Ar-Rahim, they translate as compassionate. But I think Rahman really is compassion, and both words come from the root Rahim, which is womb. The womb by which our mothers gave birth to us. So Rahma, compassion, is our home. That is where we are born. And as Muslims, we believe that our souls come into being first in the presence of Ar-Rahman, of the compassionate, before we are embodied. And so it is in compassion that we feel most at home and we feel most whole. We feel like we are where we should be. Think of so many people when they're near their deaths, even if they're very, very old, they call out for their mother. People who work with the dying know that. Or they start talking a lot. You can tell that someone might be close to death if they're talking a lot about their mother. So it is, mother is that metaphor for that original, first, primordial place in which we're born. So if that's our home, how do we wander away from home? How do we get lost from that? How do we get separated from that? If I go back to Didi, and I think she too was a child, like I was a child, what happened? And we've heard today, for example, about the science of attachment and what happens to us when we are neglected, when we're not given the love and attention and care we need. Muslims believe that God created us with what the Quran calls fitra, which this original whole disposition, a sense of wholeness, a sense of comfort in compassion, and also an awareness, a general awareness of basic right and wrong. With compassion comes a sense of justice. Now, we think of them sometimes as opposites, but they're two sides of the coin. And so, honestly, girl of the year, it was unjust. It was absurd. I mean, how to do that to all those children? What about it, you know, what made me girl of the year? Perhaps my parents were more rigorous with good manners. Maybe it's just because I was born an introvert, so I wasn't the person who was naturally running around the room and had all this extra energy. You know, I didn't do anything really to deserve it. And it was an act of injustice to her, certainly. She felt it. So when we've had our fitra, our sense of wholeness, our sense of comfort in this compassionate, whole being, when it's been covered up and we've had to, you know, follow a different path, because if you were raised by criminals and you're told this is the way, you know, to survive and you have to do it or I'll hit you, then you, and you know it's wrong, and then you have to rationalize it to yourself and you get in the habit of rationalization and you feel broken, you don't feel right. So we all, in smaller and larger parts, go away from it. But how do we return to it? And this is what I find really beautiful about our teachings, is that it's always there waiting to be uncovered. It's always there as our home to return to. We can always, maybe with a lot of work, a lot of effort, and a lot of support, get back to that state. Now, there are many kinds of people in the world, and if there are many kinds of people, introverts and extroverts and scientifically minded and creatively minded, if compassion indeed is the stamp of creation, then there must be many different ways to get back to it. And so exercising the intellect, performing good deeds, learning social norms and manners, examining our conscience, cleaning and polishing our heart of anger, envy, spite, and resentment, and holding on to faith that everyone and everything is where it should be. This is what we call in our faith, qadr, a belief that wherever we are is where we're supposed to be. And that means that even in the most difficult circumstances and circumstances of evil, we can access that original fundamental nature of compassion. And how many of you, I wonder, have gone to help people, to help a person who, out of an act of compassion, you went to help them because you felt so sorry for them, for their situation, you felt so empathetic. And there, you found that they acted so compassionately towards you. I've worked with refugees, I've worked with ill people, and every time I went to out of compassion to try to help someone, I found them even more compassionate towards me. Refugees in a refugee camp during the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, who, when they found out that I had just got married and I didn't have any family with me, and I wasn't given any, you know, jewelry or fancy clothes, refugees in a refugee camp, then 2 weeks later said, we're gonna have a wedding party for you. And they threw me a party and they sewed me a dress and they gave me gifts.
Wow.
So I think it's us, it's the privileged people who have the most difficult time really having this purity of compassion. We need to get back to it, because honestly, what makes us so special? We didn't select the family that we were born in. I didn't select my genetic makeup. You know, I didn't invent medicine in the university that I went to and all of these advantages. Yet how many of us think that we are self-made men, people? Selfishness is the big block to compassion. And so for the intellectual person to go through the simple facts that we have not made ourselves, neither our bodies nor our genetic makeup, nor did we do anything to choose our family. This is an intellectual exercise for those who may have a slightly hardened heart to look at the facts and might be able to crack open with that factual intellectual exercise a path for compassion. For many spiritual practices that are embodied, I demonstrated prayer yesterday, but things like fasting, I tell you, if I didn't have to fast once a year, I just don't know what kind of person I would be. I mean, it is a remembrance of myself, it is a remembrance of my Creator, it is also that opportunity to truly experience thirst and hunger, and that visceral understanding that can't come through reading or through someone telling you about it. You may be able to see it, but to experience is so different. And that's another path. Muhasaba, taking account of myself. And this is the interior work that if I do all of these other things, I need to do this what is called a taking of account, literally muhasaba in Arabic, where I regularly, during my prayers, add that time for what is in my heart. Is there anger in my heart? Is there envy in my heart? Is there resentment in my heart? Because all of these can be barriers and roadblocks to compassion. So clean our heart to open it and get rid of those barriers. There are so many things that we can do to open up paths of compassion. And one of them, I think, is something that we can do every day and at all places and all times, and comes from the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad, may God's peace and blessings be upon him. And I think it's this. We, especially now, we live in a society where we are told that there are so many things we don't have. We live in a culture of deprivation. Even if we have much, we feel we don't have much. The prophetic teaching, when you see someone who has more, look to someone who has less. And it is the looking. And the Prophet Muhammad, when he spoke to people and we looked at people, he looked at them full face. He didn't have his head, you know, his body turned ready to go out the door and looking. It was the full face look at people. And we know when we see the face of others and we're face to face, there is something very instinctive that opens up within us and opens up that path to compassion. And all of us can do that wherever we are. So in conclusion, I want to say there are so many avenues to explore. Sometimes people are a little bit nervous when they hear, you know, words like compassion. They think, well, I don't really like meditating, or I'm not that kind of person, or they feel that they're going to be forced to conform to a certain way of into this learning. But given that compassion is the stamp of creation, there are roads and avenues for all of us. And so I'm so happy to be able to explore that together.
Thank you, Dr. Mattson. That was very moving, and it's special being up here right now because there's so much infused compassion that I think we're not touching our chairs. It's quite amazing up here. I don't know if you're feeling it out there. I guess you are. Reflections, comments, reactions, please.
Well, thank you so much. It was really very inspiring. And I love the imagery of home. Compassion, the state of compassion as being your kind of natural home, and kind of awakening compassion, cultivating compassion is in some ways returning home. So I was wondering whether you would like to kind of flesh this out a bit more, because there is something very beautiful about this, because sometimes we have an idea that somehow we need to work hard at it, and we have to kind of, you know, this people kind of think in terms of exertion and effort. But on the other hand, if it's a matter of returning home, there's a kind of a naturalness, which means that we just happen to have strayed. But if we had strayed, we also may be able to find our way back.
And it depends how far we've wandered from home, whether it's going to be very difficult or not. And that's why it's really a collective effort to try to help, you know, to try to help people who haven't gone that far, or if they have. I mean, if you're in a thorny thicket of shrubs and you've got to, you know, break out through them, it's going to be difficult. And it may be, you may need someone to help you, you know, pull them back and give you some support. And so it really depends. But I think what I find most comforting about it is that if it's our natural state, we never lose hope for anyone. We never write anyone off. We never say they've gone so far, it's impossible for them to get back. You know, it may be awfully difficult. And the kind of, you know, we don't expect the same for everyone.
But no one is beyond redemption.
No one is. And it may be, I mean, we may not be able to fulfill our our responsibility in this life to help everyone, and they may not get the help they need, but of course we believe that this life that we're living in now is not the only plane of existence, and that there's still an opportunity for people to grow beyond that. So we never give up hope.
Thank you.
So I think you've addressed and maybe answered the question about, is compassion possible with impartiality in your response right now? I think what you said is, yes, of course. Mm-hmm. No one is beyond redemption. Everyone has this home of compassion.
And I mean, part of it is, and I mentioned this yesterday when I was demonstrating the prayer, sometimes if the source of our pain and our loss is other people, it may not be possible for some people to truly experience that compassion among other people at a certain point. Mm. Yet we're in creation that is formed by compassion. And so that's why you see, for example, with some very hardened prisoners, you know, they'll bring animals, and they'll do animal therapy with them. And that's the thing that will bring out the compassion. There is a place for everyone, but we as human beings sometimes haven't done our job very well. So for some, it may not be among us. You know, I think for most of us, it should be, and we should be able to, but we should find those spaces also for those who just can't get back to it among us. But certainly we are, you know, have brothers and sisters in all of creation, and even if it's under a tree, that is also given the compassionate shade and the coolness under that.
Good. I would like to welcome Thupten Jinpa.
I think I will try to speak from here, actually. Good afternoon. First of all, I would like to thank Owsley and the Festival of Faiths for, you know, inviting me to be part of this year's celebration. And I'm particularly honored to share this stage this afternoon to really sort of, you know, in a way, you know, kind of humbly represent the voices of the world's spiritual traditions. Because I believe that when it comes to the discourse on compassion, the voices and insights and perspectives of the world's spiritual traditions is an important one. I grew up as a Tibetan refugee child in India. My parents left Tibet in 1959. I was barely a year old. And of course, as a child, even though I was a refugee child, when you're very small, you are shielded by your ignorance of what was actually the story around you. Of course, my own parents went through the traumatic experience of displacement. But as I grew up, it became quite obvious that, you know, we were the recipients and beneficiaries of other people's compassion. The school that I went to is a boarding school that was actually funded by Save the Children's Fund, which is supported by thousands of ordinary British citizens, primarily. It's a British charity. And as I grew older, I began to notice Catholic Relief Service marked on sacks of wheat and stuff. And there was also USAID, you know, food products where with this kind of emblematic mark is a two-hand join and a handshake with the stars and stripes on the backdrop. So it was, as I began to grow older, it became very obvious that we Tibetans were beneficiaries of other people's compassion. Then, of course, having brought up in the traditional Tibetan society, compassion is really at the forefront of everyday consciousness. You know, the presence of His Holiness, who is the symbol of compassion for the Tibetans, is everywhere with images and his visits and so on. I remember my, you know, parents in the road construction camps, early morning, every morning, waking up, you know, in kind of smoke-filled tents, chanting the four immeasurable prayers, may all sentient beings be happy, may all sentient beings be free of suffering, and so on. So that was the daily prayer. So I kind of took it for granted that that's how everybody, you know, was thinking. So compassion really, so it wasn't a big deal. But as I grew older and having joined a monastic kind of community, I really began to see compassion in a much more kind of fine-tuned manner. And when I was about 12 years old, I memorized, which is a very celebrated text in the Tibetan tradition by the 8th century Buddhist thinker, Master Shantideva, called Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, or the Way of the Bodhisattva. There was a passage which says that the Buddhas, having contemplated for eons and eons, found that compassion alone to be the most beneficial. I mean, imagine a young monk reading those lines that the Buddhas, with all their omniscience, reflected for eons and eons and found compassion to be the most beneficial. And then there was another line that also intrigued me, which says that if you have a choice between, you know, revering the Buddha and making offerings to the icons versus having a chance to help another sentient being out of respecting their need, the latter should be treated as more important if you're a Buddhist. So, and then of course, as an adult, I had the privilege of being able to serve His Holiness as his principal interpreter for now over 30 years. I began in 85. So I had, in some sense, a privilege to be able to see, you know, what it means to live a compassionate life. Those of you who know His Holiness, you know, what you see is what you get. Really, here is an individual who really lives what he preaches, and you can feel the power of the compassion when you're in his presence. There's a kind of a joy as well. But normally when you think of compassion, particularly in the West, you know, we think of hardship, sacrifice, self-sacrifice, pain. But compassion can also go with joy. You can see someone like His Holiness. But this emphasis on compassion is not really unique to Buddhism. I mean, of course, in Buddhism, there is a very explicit focus on this. There's a whole meditation practice that goes with it. For example, there's a beautiful statement attributed to the Buddha, which says that, what is that one thing which when you possess, you have all the other virtues? It is compassion. So this is a statement attributed to the Buddha. So you can see the centrality of compassion as a spiritual value in the Buddhist thinking. But on the other hand, it's not unique to Buddhism. We know, as Ingrid presented, you know, powerfully, compassion is the common ground on which all the world's major religious traditions come together. You know, religions we know differ in their beliefs, narratives, doctrines, and so on. Sometimes this diversity causes a lot of confusion and conflict and division. But on the other hand, when it comes to giving a prescription on what it means to live a good life, what we should do and what we should not do, really there's a striking convergence on the lists, even the list of the prescriptions across the traditions. And that's because at the foundation of all the ethical teachings of the world religions is the basic golden rule: do unto others what you wish others to do unto you. Basically, this is because the central question of ethics is really the question of how should I treat others? That's the central question of ethics. Question of ethics is about how you treat others, and you would want to be treated by others in the manner in which they respect your dignity as a human being, your basic aspiration for happiness and wish to avoid suffering. That is compassion. Basically, you would want others to treat you with a sense of compassion and understanding of your own humanity and basic needs. So no wonder there is, you know, we find a version of golden rule in almost all the religious traditions. I mean, there's a slight variations in how it is phrased, but essentially it's the same. Now, the reason why I'm particularly inspired to be part of this panel here is because when it comes to discourse on compassion, if you don't include the voices of the spiritual traditions, we are ignoring a huge richness of the history of human thinking and experience that has gone before science became the dominant discourse. And here, we are able, if we bring the religious voice, we will be able to bring a kind of a richness that is not there. And of course, sometimes we're reluctant, particularly in the public discourse, to bring religious perspectives because we are wary of all the differences. But compassion is one area there's a real commonality. So why ignore that? Now, of course, today the difference is, as we saw this morning from the Mind and Life session, that there is a new kid on the block, that's science. Science is now talking about compassion. And the beauty of bringing science as part of a discussion on this important topic is that science has a tendency to naturalize and normalize and universalize the concepts and the language around it. And also for a lot of people, science is what makes things real. They can measure, they can calculate, they can demonstrate. So I think science being part of that discourse is a good thing. But on the other hand, we all know from our own personal experience, individual level, we don't need science to tell us about the importance of compassion. We all know from our own personal experience what compassion means to us. Each one of us knows what it is intuitively. You know, when we are in a most distressed state of mind, the most powerful approach is someone listening to our needs compassionately, being fully there present, and giving us a hug. And as parents, I'm a parent of two kids, I know that when a child is completely distressed, no amount of talking is going to calm that child down. The instinctive thing, the smart thing to do is to grab the child and hug tightly for a while. And even the heart rate goes down. And this is, as Ingrid pointed out, that's our home because we're trying to make the child return home. And we know, and also when we experience compassion for someone, which we, by the way, sometimes when we listen to talking about compassion from the religious perspective, we tend to elevate it so high that we can't identify with it. But we mustn't forget, compassion is a natural human sentiment. All of us have this capacity. You know, those who have been parents know that when a two-year-old is in total distress, throwing tantrum in front of you, you are there fully for that child. I mean, a scientist may say, oh, that's because biologically that's your child, there is a gene propagation motivation going behind the scene and all the rest. But the fact is, in that moment, your perspective is completely for the other. There is no selfish agenda. You have a tremendous amount of patience because you have opened your heart. And same thing, if we allow, can happen in the case of a total stranger. If a total stranger has been knocked down by, you know, a car or something and it's bleeding and in agony, most of us are not going to stay back and say, do I know this person? Does he speak my language? Do we have the same religion? We're not going to do that. We're just going to completely feel for this person and respond to the situation. That is compassion. So when compassion, I mean, I define compassion as the natural sense of concern that arises when we are confronted with someone's suffering or need, and we wish to do something about it. So when compassion arises, three things happen very quickly, almost simultaneously. One is you see the situation and you understand it. It's a need or a pain. You feel emotionally connected with this and moved by it. That is empathy. You feel for it or feel with the person. And then you want to see the situation change. That's the motivation component. And if this compassion is stronger, maybe you want to do something about it yourself. That is a compassion. That's a natural response. We don't really have to learn. Now, the beauty of science is that science is showing us that the more we are able to live at that level, in that space, respond to ourselves, to our loved ones, to the world around us, from that place, rather than from the place of negative judgment and criticism, then we ourselves are better off. That's why His Holiness often says that the first beneficiary of your compassion is yourself. You know, whether the compassion translates into something that is really beneficial to the other person depends on many other factors. The person may not be ready to receive your compassion. There might be other factors that are beyond your control, but you actually experience the benefit yourself because you open your heart. And when you are able to allow, when you allow to open your heart, you feel expansive. In that space, you actually feel quite great. I mean, that's not your motivation, though, of course, but when you are able to allow your or open your heart, you really feel that. So now science is beginning to show all of these benefits. And also, science is increasingly pointing out that compassion is part of our natural human quality. So in the old days, scientists came up with this idea that basic human nature was competitive and selfish, and ultimate human aspiration or motivation was to pursuit of self-interest. But now they're opening up, because that's a very narrow, one-sided picture of the human reality. Human reality is much more complex. So this shows that compassion is part of our natural makeup. Compassion is good for us. Now, the contemplative traditions, particularly the Buddhist tradition, which has a rich meditation practices, is also showing that we can do something about it. We can make it more of a proactive stance. Because normally what happens is that we leave it to the situation, like anger. When we are triggered, we get angry. When we are inspired, we get compassionate. But we leave it at that. But what the kind of the science and the contemplative science is particularly showing is we can actually be more proactive and learn to make compassion an active standpoint from which we can relate to situations, to ourselves, to those around us, and to the world, you know, around us. And if we're able to do that, I mean, in the end, of course, that is a choice, because we have huge amount of resources from which we can relate to the world, to anger, judgment, fear, and so on. So in the end, it's a matter of choice. But if we do make that choice to relate to situations around us, to ourselves and others from a place of compassion, everything changes. That I can promise you. But the choice is up to us individually. So, of course, when we think about along these lines, then His Holiness's statement, which seemed quite paradoxical, also makes perfect sense. There's a statement that His Holiness made where he says that if you wish others to be happy, practice compassion, and if you wish yourself to be happy, practice compassion. So I think that's a powerful and beautiful statement, and we, each of us, really, it's in our hand, you know, and the way to do that is to pay conscious attention to compassion in our everyday life, make compassion part of our everyday intention so that we learn to relate to situations from a compassionate standpoint. And one of the most beautiful things about compassion for me is it provides a sense of purpose. You know, when we are able to relate to others from a sense of compassion, we feel kind of, you know, needed. We feel valued. And also, the thing about a sense of purpose is that it really then makes us much more motivated, you know, to be able to be for others. So all around, when we choose compassion, we are able to escape this narrow confines of self-interest. Sometimes we tend to get locked in, especially when we are living in a very competitive consumerist society. So compassion is really one of those things that is least appreciated, particularly in contemporary culture. So I would like to appeal to all of you to take a look at compassion with this kind of a new eyes and try to make it real in your everyday life. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Reflections, comments, reactions?
It's interesting because you'll find the, you know, when you talked about being there for your child, right? And some people saying, well, that's because you want to preserve your genes,
sure,
or something like this. This is part of the challenge with bringing science into the equation is a very is the idea that somehow this is the, that when we explain something scientifically, that it's the fundamental thing. So there's a kind of like hierarchy of explanation, whereas scientific language is just another language. And you can explain the same thing in many ways. So how do you, when you talk to scientists, how do you sort of articulate that reality?
I mean, you actually pointed it out, because one of the things about science is that science is a particular way of understanding a phenomenon. They have a certain boundaries in which they operate, which involves measurability, and also which, and particularly in relation to something like compassion, you know, science can only get involved if there are some behavioral expressions, mm-hmm. whether it is at the level of brain processes or physical behavior or verbal behavior. But the phenomenon itself, what we call compassion, at the moment lies beyond science. I mean, of course, a scientist would say, you know, the compassionate mind is basically the brain state, but that's a kind of a metaphysical question. So I think most of the kind of, you know, more discerning scientists are aware of that. So I don't think that's a problem. But of course, there are some people, particularly coming from the scientific background, who have a much more totalizing view of science, that somehow, if it is real, science will be able to explain it. And if it doesn't fall into that remit, then it's somehow not real. Right. But then those are, of course, not going to be particularly interested in sitting down with people who are going to talk from the perspective of the interior landscape. Yes, yeah.
So science is kind of the modern idiom for many people. There are many people without faith, and many people who would like to be compassionate. Maybe they are, maybe they're not. And so in a way, science can become a bridge for many people. It can give, it can lend some credibility to all of this for those people that want to have measurement and numbers. Yes. And from that, they can move on to more a secular kind of approach, which is the same compassion, I believe, that is also faith-driven. But this can be an inroad for a lot of, particularly young people that have more of a scientific, rational mind and don't have much to do with faith.
Sure.
Except that there has to be one thing, that it can be a bridge, but it can also be a brick wall. And that if we begin to buy, and you alluded to this Ingrid, that everything is under a function of a certain determinism, and the whole question raised of, well, if you've had lousy nurture, or if you have a lousy nature, you may not be capable of compassion. That circumstances might prevent you from doing it, and I think what the spiritual traditions have to say is that compassion emerges in the domain that represents a freedom which is unconditioned, and that human beings at every point in their life, no matter what kind of genes they have or history they have equal access to the unconditioned realm. And since that's beyond measurement, it sort of has to be taken on faith, but not that old blind faith of the past, because the priest told you so, but on some deeper capacity of the heart to validate through its own empiricism.
So it would be very nice, maybe in our next discussion, after we hear our last speaker, to come back to this question of how can we cultivate it when it's not present. We know it's natural, we know it's a natural stand, it's home, but sometimes we're not in that space, and how can we come back to that? But I'd like to now please welcome Cynthia Bourgeau.
Okay, over we go. Good, thank you. Thank you. I did mine with a music stand with notes on it, so I can look utterly deceitful and walk around like this as if I know what I'm doing. But what I want to do is actually raise a couple of questions and perspectives on this. It's more that of a question than it is a statement. That I think one of the real problems that we get into when we try, particularly in the West, to understand compassion, and this was right there in that film that we saw from that variety of responses, is a lot of people have a hard time distinguishing it from pity or from charity. And what happens, or from being a helper, and there's a subtle sort of, as we understand compassion, it implies a subtle power differential, you know, so that very often we place ourselves through an identification on the side of the haves, We are the ones that are practicing compassion or doing compassion, and we are the doers, and then there are the done untos. And it's like that, the great prayer, thank God I am not like other men. But there for the grace of God go I. We'll drop out the but for the grace of God. There go I, and we're closer. So how do you eliminate the power differential? Because true compassion is not like that at all. True compassion is like love, like eros, in that it levels the playing field and creates out of what were hierarchical human relationships a single wholeness. You spoke to that so beautifully, Ingrid, when you talked about the refugees making your wedding gown. Mm-hmm. That the final result of compassion and a compassionate action is that there is the healing and the empowerment of the whole. So we have to ask this, and of course Jesus was right onto this. One of the most popular of his teachings, the powerful one, was in the parable of the Good Samaritan, where the haves walked right by the person in distress. And it was the one who was the have-not, the Samaritan, the pariah, who was actually able to break the trap. And I think that what Jesus was talking about there was watch out. Watch out. Don't place yourself in the position of the entitled one, of the helping one, of the powerful or the strong one. Turn the table upside down and see what you get. We all know the love your neighbor as yourself. But we always hear that as love your neighbor as much as yourself. And then, but I have to love myself first. And we don't realize that there's no comparison in there. Love your neighbor as yourself, one individual. So it really is fundamentally an act of seeing. The doing will fall out of the seeing. We don't see from the oneness. We don't know how to see from the oneness. We don't even know that we're not seeing from the oneness. And there's the dilemma, the rub. So what do you do about that? Well, in the spiritual traditions that I come from, which is basically the Christian tradition informed deeply by the Sufi tradition, we have a whole kind of teaching about something called identification. It's a form of an attachment to your sense of self, to your self-image, or even deeper than your self-image, your sense of persona, your image of yourself as a helper, or as a compassionate person, or as a victim. We carry these little identifications inside them, and we don't see them, and we don't want to see them, because particularly in the Western tradition that most of us have grown up steeped in, we actually use attachment as the motivator for righteous action. And we can't imagine a righteous action happening apart from attachment. So it's the Old Testament model of zeal for the Lord is burning up the house. And we identify ourselves with the good person, with the moral high ground, with the right, with the one who's God's little helper, with the one that's doing. I don't think anybody ever self-identifies as the one who's doing the wrong thing. You know? So we subtly steal the moral high ground. And we don't even see we're doing it. And as a matter of fact, I've often been told, people throw in my face, Jesus throwing the money changers out of the temple. And they say, well, you know, you got to be angry. You got to have a sense of justice in order to be able to act righteously and compassionately in the world. This tradition says, no, not so. That's the blinder that's always introducing the power differential and skewing compassion into pity and do-gooding. So one of the most powerful, powerful quotes I know comes from a Christian teacher now dead, Gerald May, who developed the Institute, the Shalem Institute for Spiritual Guidance for Formation. He has a wonderful, challenging koan in his book, Will and Spirit. He says, as attachment ceases to be your motivation, your actions will become reflections of compassion absolute. As attachment ceases to be your motivation, your actions will become reflections of compassion absolute. It's amazing. What he's saying, in other words, is that your attachment is the blind spot there, the thumb over the camera lens. And as you let go of it, what you begin to see is that the world actually is Rahim. It is the womb, the fundamental nature of reality, whether you call it God, interdependent, arising, what you name it, is it's ordered and structured. It's relational, it's personal, it's compassionate. And once you see that, that tidal wave of the actual fundamental nature of reality is what rises up to carry you into a compassionate action, which is judgment-free and no role-playing. But so to see the world as one, to see the world as coherent and compassionate, is really the challenge, is really that amazing flip of the light bulb. What our Western tradition has said very, very clearly here is that only the heart can see it. The mind can never see the world as a coherent, unconditioned whole, because that requires the heart to kick in. The heart, as it's understood in the West, not as a source of emotion, not even as a source of empathy, but as an organ of spiritual perception, which perceives by vibrational resonance, by being able to enter the insides of things and sense holographically the pattern from the whole. And over and over and over in the West comes the refrain, put the mind in the heart, put the mind in the heart, which doesn't mean get out of your mental constructions and start feeling. What it means in scientific language, which some of my friends in the neurology business say is we can begin to measure, is to entrain the rhythms and the vibrational field of the brain to the vibrational field of the heart, so they form a single instrument of perception. And so over and over and over, spiritual practice says, put the mind in the heart, put the mind in the heart. As that happens, A, that conditioned self, that busy translator, acting, doing good, participating, motivating, gone. And what you begin to see on the inside is the world looks intimate. Because intimacy is the feeling tone, is the objective real description of the world seen from the perspective of the heart. There's an intimate belongingness, a cohesiveness, a coherence from the field. So when you look at the world from the heart and see intimacy, action flows out as effortless compassion. That's the external side of the coin, of which the internal is the heart perceived intimacy. And another word for that kind of a condition might really simply be to work out of conscience. And I'd like to introduce this word and ask us to reclaim it, to taste it, because often we confuse conscience with morality or with learned social norms or with that little voice that Paul was talking about this morning that beats up on you all day. You ought to do that, you ought to do that, you ought to know that. Conscience is simply the heart centered, the eye of the heart wide open, perceiving the scale of things, perceiving the love, the equalizing, leveling love that flows through everything, pulling it into one. And when we see from that eye of conscience. We see from the oneness, we see from the humility, we see from the compassion that flows out into the world in a whole new way. So the point of the spiritual practices is to try to open up the conditions and help us remember the practices that move us from that middle calculating, acting, identified self into simply that whole oneness that can see what I really believe, that compassion does not belong to the individual even. It is an emergent property of the whole. And as we realign and reorient and reground ourselves in the whole, compassion flows. So, last image to leave you with. We're here in Louisville. It's my first time I've ever been in Louisville, but I've known Louisville for years from Thomas Merton, from that wonderful thing that's formed the actual theme song of our conscience. My hotel, as for many of you, is right in the corner of what used to be 4th and Walnut, in the middle of the shopping district, where he realizes, I loved all those people. I could not be separate from them. I was theirs. They were mine. And he says, I woke from this funny and spurious dream of belonging to this false special realm. And I could say, thank God, I am like other men. And it's from that seeing that everything shifted in Merton's life. It's like the watershed epiphany in his life. And all of a sudden, he moved from pity, charity, compassion is something you did, to the natural flowing of this different kind of seeing. And his final words in that beautiful, beautiful statement is, I have no formula for that seeing, but the gates of heaven are everywhere. So in this city, in this place, on this occasion, I would merely ask us to believe that when as the tradition says, that as our sense of self comes down into the heart, that something opens that allows the rest to flow from a whole different place. And as we're able to do that, we shift the whole art and science of compassion to a whole new ground. So keep striving and working for that transpersonal, personal openness of the heart. And the rest, the gates of heaven are everywhere. Thank you.
If that wasn't from the heart, I don't know what is. Reflections, reactions.
It was, thank you so much. It was very, very inspiring. I love the idea of this progressive path where we have to start somewhere. And the place to start is the kind of the narrow, natural compassion that we all possess. And then moving on to this transpersonal compassion. So in your understanding, would that path be more of a kind of a, involve a kind of a disjunction so that you let go of this natural love, that parental love that we have for our loved ones, our friends, and so on, which is, of course, involved with attachment. Mm-hmm. So this transpersonal level of compassion, the path to that would involve a kind of a disruption and disjunction, or would you see a possibility of a kind of a progressive evolution, like an organic evolution?
I definitely see it as a progressive, a both and, because the that I think that what the great spiritual teachers have said is that when we don't see what we think is our love as we start at a certain level of selfhood is always kind of infused with agendas that are clinging and sentimental. Mm-hmm. And when we first go away from that, it looks like we're not loving anymore. You know, that question that God asked this morning about can you do the action from the impartial place? Yeah, but the impartial place is scary to us at first. And so what I love about the meditation practices is that they bracket that experience. Like in centering prayer, you only do it for 20 minutes twice a day. And for 20 minutes, if the image comes up of your child or your baby or whatever, or the suffering in the world, you learn that the practice is to let it go. Not renounce it, but let it go. So you're getting used to being able to abide in the state where you're not pulling things close to you and emoting about them all the time. Mm-hmm. So you do that for 20 minutes, and then you go out and live your life. But little by little, that shifts the center of selfhood so that you're less and less dependent on the micro-drama in order to generate your sense of identity. And it, I think it happens very slowly and naturally over the course of however long it takes a person to integrate the thing according to their own wonderful particularity.
Thank
that
you.
Would be, mm-hmm. How do you see that, Ingrid?
Yeah, it's, I think it's, I'm in education and in so many fields now, the whole, everything is measured by outcomes. So, you know, unless you're meeting some outcome, you're not doing anything. It's so destructive to education from the beginning. And this is the key is that in that cultural context, in a way, I feel like we've never been in a place that's more antithetical to that kind of dispassionate compassion and love. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how you change a culture like that, but somehow, at least for those who want to, you know, I mean, this idea of I'm a helper, I'm doing things, I want to do things, and then they have to get funding.
Yeah,
you know, to do these things, and what's your outcomes, and
yeah, right.
It's just there's a lot of practical obstacles in the midst of this, and I don't know if you have any solution to that.
My own is to try to stay below the radar screen.
There is a practice in Buddhism, which we call Mahamudra. There's another one, Dzogchen. And it's precisely what you were talking about. In meditation, you're wide open. Your senses are wide open. Your mind, your heart, everything is wide open. Mm-hmm. But you stick to nothing. Mm-hmm. So it's continual letting go. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't know, I have no experience, but people that do this for year in, year out, they say that after the 20 minutes or whatever on the cushion, you go out in the world, and slowly there's a little less attachment.
Yeah, I think it's gradual. And I think I take refuge in the collective nature of reality, that everywhere across the spectrum, somebody doing something, a concentrated group of work like the folks in Dharamsala doing Mahamudra, are carrying the people like you that are trying to get funding to get a university program in that softens it up, carries those amazingly good initiatives of C-care and mindfulness and all those things. We're carrying each other, and we're gradually changing the climate of our collective.
I think this is what the physicists call entanglement.
Yeah, quantum entanglement. I mean, gotta love it. I mean, if there isn't...
So what I would like to do at this point, excuse me, please. Let's take 1 minute. Please stretch and move, and then after 1 minute, come on back down. We have some lovely music for you.
Yeah.
And now if you can please slowly return to your seats. And we are extremely fortunate. It was a harmonic conversion, I think. We have one of the world's greatest neck players, and his name, if I can find it here, I put it on the other sheet. His name is Selek Gurez, and he happened to be in Texas for a world event, and we were able to bring him here. So this is something extremely special. I'd like to welcome Selek Gurez.
Thank you.
Boy, we need more of that. I think we ought to play it from all the buildings all around town, all around the state and the country and the world. That just brings you right in, you know. Beautiful, beautiful. We're very, very fortunate. We're going to now transition into a discussion, to broaden our discussion that we started earlier. I'd like to come back to this question, maybe to start it with, and that is, when we're not in the space, if we're not, you know, if we are attaching and grabbing and we find our heart is kind of a bit closed and we're under a lot of stress and we have time issues, you know, what can we do to try to loosen that tight grip and to find that home, that place of compassion?
Maybe I'll start because I had the privilege to develop a 8-week compassion training program at Stanford, known as CCT, or Compassion Cultivation Training, which is now going to be offered more widely through another nonprofit entity called Compassion Institute, which has just recently been set up. This question of impartiality versus attachment and whether or not that is a stumbling block was an important question, because in a natural state, the compassion that we all know is the compassion that we naturally feel for our loved ones. So, Ingrid, you pointed out about the kind of the imagery of the mother's womb as kind of image. And in the Buddhist text, in the Metta Sutta, for example, the discourse on loving kindness, the Buddha actually gives the imagery of the mother's unconditional love for her child as the measure of having developed compassion for all beings. But on the other hand, to ask that at the beginning is just too much of a tall order. So how do we then proceed? And one of the things that I struggled with is really this question of attachment. How do you take it gently? You know, really kind of utilize what nature has gifted you from a scientific language. You know, I mean, we all have this impulse to care for our loved ones. And then gently build it up on this. And here, one thing that I found very helpful is in the Buddhist kind of, you know, psychology, there is this powerful insight that empathy for another person really presupposes a certain idea of an identification, a sense of connection with the other. And that's one of the reasons why we have in-groups and out-groups, and for the out-group, we don't feel for their pain because we have chosen not to identify with them. And that's also the reason why, in the case of an acute pain, we're able to feel this even to a total stranger, because the pain is a powerful connector. You know, when someone is in total agony, that cuts right through all the layers of discrimination, label, and all the rest, because the fundamental reality of human experience speaks to our understanding of pain and, you know, instinctual wish to avoid it. So that's why pain is such a powerful connector. So we have used this, and this is actually how in the Buddhist meditation proceeds as well. So in a sense, what you're doing is, instead of getting rid of your attachment to your loved ones and to your small circle, we actually build on it to really say, well, basically what you're doing is you are expanding the scope of your identification. And you do that by reflecting deeply upon the shared humanity. And we use this meditation called Just Like Me. Just like me, he wishes to be happy. Just like me, he doesn't want to have problem. And that way, we're really getting to this very fundamental level of reality of human condition, where vulnerability to suffering, to pain, all of this is part of what makes who we are. And so that's the approach we have used, so that it's, I suppose, in a sense, it's kind of gently leading by the hand in a kind of a softly way. So that's how we have tackled that issue, because in the end, the highest form of compassion does presuppose impartiality. I mean, it's a kind of a, in some case, it's a kind of a, it doesn't really matter who the other person is. It's a bit like the notion of justice. The reason why we put Lady Liberty as a blindfolded is that the recipient of the justice shouldn't matter. White, black, Asian, Asiatic, educated or uneducated, justice is impartial. And the highest form of compassion is, in fact, an impartial. It doesn't really matter whose suffering it is. Suffering is suffering, full stop. You respond to it. But to get there is a real challenge.
Yeah, it's interesting how these are sort of complementary approaches. One that you're talking about is to start with a small circle in which you can count that empathy will be reliable and gradually extend the membership of that circle. And I think that's a good, and using the term identification that way to just say that we become identified with the whole of sentient being. And the other that I think is complementary is to just spot attachment wherever it occurs and realize that if you could, you could drop it altogether, so that, yeah, what makes you so special, that what remains by default is compassion. It's a wager. But in response to your question, I would say that one of the things you can do when you notice you're in a bad state, there's something that notices that, and that's wonderful. I mean, when you, to say, to notice, you know, my heart is stressed. If you could just begin to create and collect a data bank that says that nothing good can come out of a heart that's braced, defended, and attached, no matter how just your cause, if you're the energetic component is always stronger than the than your. So as you just notice, angry, tight. Just the act of noticing, even if you can't shift the state, will already shift the state. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
It's much more important than anyone would think.
Hmm. Sounds very much to me like a Dzogchenpa, a deep practitioner of Dzogchen. Please, Ingrid.
I mean, regular practices of breaking those attachments temporarily help us. And this is why fasting, breaking the attachment to not only food, but that conviviality that happens of eating with other people, that's so important to creating connection. Also the energy that starts to drain, so you're not as, you know, when you're really well fed and well rested and you've got all this energy and it's like, I have to accomplish this. Mm-hmm. But when that's taken away from you, you have a little bit less energy, and then you're like, you know what, having a little bit less energy allows you to see some other things. So I think those, to be able to integrate some of those detachment practices, you know, ascetic practices, whatever we would call it, fasting for a time, halwa, withdrawing from people for a time. So that's something that can be part of fasting for Muslims during Ramadan. It could be part of the fast of Ramadan, is actually detaching yourself for a while from your home, from your family. Giving away those things, constantly divesting ourselves of those things that we love. But another way, I think, is, and this is a, you know, it's a long spiritual tradition, is travel and going away for a while, making yourself really completely vulnerable to putting yourself in a place where you don't have attachments. You can't rely on those, that community or friends or family that you're used to doing so much for and them doing for you. When you're in that situation of complete vulnerability, suddenly you see how it's all there still, you know? You see everywhere, you see kindness and goodness, and then you're able to say, well, you know, I thought I was just building this up here. I thought it relied on me. I thought everything was dependent on me and us building this up. But I think it's that being vulnerable through travel, through detachment, going away for a while and coming back is very helpful.
You mentioned Mahasabha. Did I pronounce it right? Ingrid? I didn't pronounce it right.
Yeah.
The accent's on the wrong part. Mahasabha?
Oh, Mahasabha.
Mahasabha.
Yes, yes.
Okay, thank
taking
you.
Into account. It's like it's accounting, really, literally. Uh-huh. It's accounting. So to, and this can be done, of course we can do it any time, but it's good to have a discipline of doing it at certain times to get in the practice, to start to make it a habit. And then we notice when these things are arising. So if we make it a regular practice, say in the morning or the evening, taking into account what are my negative emotions, envy, anger, hopelessness, spite, all of these things, if I'm taking those into account in a peaceful state, remembering them, counting them up, and then saying, okay, those happened, letting them go, I'm going to do better next time. Then when they arise during the moment, during the day, as they come up in that moment, we're going to be able to recognize them more easily, and then be able to back away from that. So I think that's a, like so many things, at first we need to, this is where the discipline comes in and where the teachers and the helpers to help us get in the habit of doing these things until they become natural, until, you know, we might not even need to have them in our calendar anymore because they become part of our state.
So there was a great saint, a Buddhist saint, about 1,000 years ago, Dipankara Atisha. And it's said that the story is, the legend, that when he noticed a negative thought or feeling, he would put a little black stone. And when he noticed a positive feeling or thought, he put a white stone. And at first there were these big, huge masses of black stones. Couldn't even see anything white. And then slowly, you know, with just recognition. Mm-hmm. Of course, I think he probably did more than just recognition, but recognition was a powerful part of this. It shifted, and eventually, you know, there was a bigger pile of white stones. Mm-hmm. So doing this
Mahasabha,
mm-hmm. thank you, mm-hmm. is quite powerful. So I guess I need to direct it here. So let's see. So we went on one end. We went on one end where, you know, we're just not finding, we're not juiced. You know, we're overstressed and we're clinging and we're attached. And how can we a little bit, you know, loosen things to find some compassion? Let's go on the other extreme. Let's talk about this non-duality of letting go and just being compassion and not having any attachments. Let's flesh that out a little bit, please.
Well, I'd say that I think one of the dysfunctional roadmaps we've inherited from our tradition is the idea of, you know, of progressive enlightenments to the point that your false self drops away, and what's left is your true self, and your true self is not attached, and it's non-dual, and it has no identities, and you live in it happily ever after. And I think that's generations of people just marching right off the cliff into the river of lava. That as long as we're incarnate, we bear this wonderful, difficult, excruciating task of reconciling within in our own being the one and the many, the particular and the universal, the one who can live perfectly, happily, and comfortably in that non-aligned state, and the one who is all of a sudden, oh my God, my child has just died. I mean, and these are the two parts. They're the Christian language would be the crucifixion, the glory of our being. And so to learn how to keep them in a wise dialogue, rather than trying to use the spiritual to devalue and flatten and frankly repress the temporal. And I thought a lot of the bad press that non-duality has gotten nowadays is because we've used it that way. We've used the high side for spiritual bypassing. So we're talking about an integrated approach, and sometimes, frankly, it's important to work out of that small self. Sometimes that kind of karate chop energy is what needs to be brought to a situation. But it will work better if it's already deeply grounded in a lived experience that other is also real in you. So that would be my
lovely comments, reflections, reactions.
Well, thank you for that, because sometimes listening to spiritual perspectives, particularly on compassion, tends to make it unreachable. You know, it's up there. When in reality, compassion and these qualities are part of our everyday reality. You know, we may not be particularly articulate, many of us, or may not pay much attention to it, but that's there. So thank you for that clarification. One of the interesting things for me, coming from the Buddhist tradition, is which here I think the Buddhist tradition is actually quite close to the scientific understanding that compassion as a felt response is, I think, really contingent upon a concrete reality. This is the reason why there is something called, you know, altruism collapse. So we are able to feel compassion for individuals, and then after a certain number, you know, we just can't maintain that. There's a kind of a certain finite numbers beyond which. So, for example, there's a reason why charity commercials use real children rather than give you statistics. You know, we don't respond to, you know, your dollar will cover this amount of people, that X amount of people suffering. That doesn't appeal to us. That doesn't pull at our, you know, tug at our heart. But a child suffering and asking for something really pulls and tug at our heart. So, and that is the reality of our compassionate response. So compassion as a felt response really seemed to require individuals, human beings, suffering, need. But compassion, so I would like to see a distinction between compassion as a felt response and compassion as a kind of a, almost one could say, a standpoint, a perspective. Now, compassion as a perspective, you don't need concrete, because you are now working at the level of your intention. You're working at the level of motivation, your character development, so that you are primed to respond to any situation in a compassionate way, but your actual compassionate training doesn't really involve concrete reality. And this is how, so in, and in that way, when you generate compassion, you can generate compassion for all beings, because you don't need individuals to inspire that compassion. But I think to get there, I think we need to somehow cultivate that felt compassion, which requires, which does require real suffering, which does require the perception of real need. And in a way, that's a kind of a, you know, maybe a dichotomy, but I, that's why I thank you very much for pointing out that it's a kind of a both path. You need to somehow, you cannot undermine the other at the expense of one. Would you agree with that?
I would certainly, exactly. And I think that we've done so much damage in the spiritual path by pitting the two selves against each other, rather than understanding that they vastly extend the range of oneself.
Thank you.
I think part of compassion as a perspective is related to what I would call, is related to trust. What we call tawakkul. So, and what I trust is that when I say, when I look at compassion as a perspective, is that I know, because this is what is the form, the substance of being, that it's okay. I know that, you know, I come to Louisville and I'm going to find all these compassionate people and all these compassionate things going on, and I don't have to be, I don't have to stay here and work on every project. And so I know when we see there's so much going on, but we don't become overwhelmed by it, because we have trust. We have that trusting knowledge, awareness that it is there too. You know, if we think of ourselves here, and I have to work on this in my realm, and this is what's in front of me, I'm not worried that nothing's going on over there. And I think it's really important to have that, so it's not detachment and I don't care, or it doesn't affect me, but I know that it's happening in everywhere. It's one, you know, it's one sheet. It's the warp and weft of the universe. And so I think that trust is so related to the perspective of compassion.
This is beautiful. We're just warming up. And we have to finish. So I hope that this discussion will continue with all of you.